This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode of the Book Riot Podcast is brought to you by Madison Reed. If you're looking to freshen up your hairstyle before Valentine's Day, but don't have time to make it to the salon or wait for the next available appointment, never fear. Madison Reed offers salon-quality hair color from the convenience of your home at a fraction of the price. With premium ingredients and expert assistance, Madison Reed has everything you need to color your hair at home with confidence. Find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. That's the dash, the punctuation mark. Don't spell out dash. Madison-reed, R-E-E-D.com. And get 10% off plus free shipping on your first color kit when you use offer code BOOKRIOT. This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 195. We're recording on Monday, February 6th. I'm Jeff O'Neill. I'm here with Robanda Nelson. We're coming to you from BookRiot.com. It's been a long, torturous road to get us to record even late.
Oh my gosh.
And we're still here.
People are texting the Book Riot account or tweeting at it, like, where's the podcast? I'm like, we haven't even
We haven't even done it. And listen, last week we were late as well for reasons. Oh, I had stomach flu last week and I couldn't get the show posted. This week there was a snow day here. Rebecca was off skiing and she's recuperating, coming back in the office today. And then Amanda's kids got sick when we were so it's been a horrible mess. So trust me, our lives have been worse than yours over the last. I'm sure some of you had a crappier week than that, but we're delayed for good reasons. I as a podcast listener myself, I am attuned to the habitual form of, like, you expect on a certain day, and if it's like 24 hours late, it's like, oh my God, why are they doing this to me? But anyway, Amanda, welcome back to the show. It's been a little while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good to be back.
What's new in the Book Riot world we should tell people about? Anything we should hit them up with?
There's some stuff on sale.
There's a big sale. You can go check that out too. The hoodies are 25% off.
Yeah, and there's a new one that I Lift hardcovers hoodie, which is great, and has a barbell with, like, books on the end instead of weights. It's very clever.
You can go check that out. And let's see. Oh, I don't know if you also check out. I'll put a link in the show notes. We're doing in February, sort of an Instagram challenge.
Kelly's brainchild.
The hashtag is Riotgrams. If you're on Instagram and or Twitter, you can find it there. But, you know, every day there's a different challenge, a bookish related picture to take. So, you know, it's February, a shorter month, but also I think we could all use a little distraction or a little more, you know, community building.
It's fun. I think today's thing is a book or a character, a book with an author name or character name that is your first name. And I can't think of a single one for Amanda. Like, I don't, maybe I need to go search some, like, R.L. Stein books from the 80s.
Yeah, I was going to say it's much more recent. Right. You have to be. I can't think of a Jeff off the top of my head either. Again, I'm mostly villains from 80s movies. You know, I got a sweater
tied
around.
You could Eugenides.
Oh, it's author? I thought it was character. I was thinking of character.
Oh, it's either.
I'm sorry. Oh, it's either. Oh, yeah. Okay. Jeffrey Eugenides. That's not bad. That's pretty good. All right, let's get to our first sponsor before we get into the week of news. It's Casper is back. I don't know about you, but anything that can help me sleep a little bit better right now, I'm interested in. I'm just putting that out there right now. And Casper, that's what it is. It's an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It's got this supportive memory foam that creates an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. So there's a couple things that are annoying about buying a mattress. Like, if you go into a regular store or mattress store, where it's, you know, basically it's like sleep coffins. They're all, like, you know, laying around. It's kind of eerie and creepy, all these empty mattresses. But there's a couple things that are annoying. One is you've got so many choices, right? Are you going to get this kind of top, that kind of top, this kind of spring, blah, blah, blah. And then you got to get it home. You got to get your old mattress out of there, and that's assuming you like it. If you don't like it, it's a horrible mess. You got to go take it back and get it in a flatbed truck, and you have to ask your one friend that has a pickup truck. How is it possible that we all have, like, the one friend that has a pickup truck that gets asked to do everything? Also, never buy a pickup truck, because then you'll get asked to do everything all the time, like take crappy mattresses back. With Casper, they realize, okay, it's annoying enough to have to get a new mattress, so let's keep our choices to a couple things. One, there's really only one, and that is what size. because they have the same memory foam. It's like, this is the best one for most people are going to be super happy with this. So we're going to go with this. So you have to think about and decide what and blah. And the other thing is the getting it to your house. And should you not like it out of your house, they figured it out. You get a 100-night risk-free in-home trial. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. So, you know, you can get in there. I've had this happen with a mattress before I bought, and I sleep on it for a few nights. Like, this was a horrible mistake. How did this happen? And you're like mattress jail because you can't get it out of there. It's a horrible mess. And so you're stuck sleeping on a bad mattress for like 12 years. I might be speaking from experience myself. I'm just putting it out there. So they understand the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially you're going to spend a third of your life on it. And that's assuming you don't have young kids. And that's more like, you know, a fifth of your life. Mm. Free shipping and returns to US and Canada. And you can get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/bookriot and using offer code bookriot. It's Casper, casper.com/bookriot. Go get yourself a new mattress. Sleep a little bit better and make it easy for you to get that annoying floppity thing out of your house and a new one in there. Okay, well, this is something I've been wondering about for a long time. Are you a Dune fan? Have you read Dune?
I've read all of them.
You've done all of them. I think maybe we've talked about this before, actually, now that you say that. And the original, well, the extant adaptation of Dune with Kyle MacLachlan as Atreides is, I mean, it's an interesting train wreck. But you're not gonna, you know, really want to watch. It's not objectively good and entertaining, and it's a huge franchise and probably the largest franchise out there in sci-fi. Maybe Asimov's Foundation series. We could debate about that, but it's certainly one that doesn't have a good multi-installment adaptation out there. And we have very interesting news in that director Denis Villeneuve, who directed Arrival and Sicario, is officially signed up to direct a Dune reboot, I guess is what we're calling it. Brian Herbert, the son of Frank, who wrote the original novel, confirmed it. So there we go. Both TV and film rights to Dune, so I don't know if there might be some sort of ancillary thing that goes along with the movies. That seemed to be something that's happening these days. But there we is. What do you think about that? Are you excited? Are you interested? Does a director matter to you? What are your thoughts and feelings?
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I feel like there was another one after the Kyle MacLachlan one, though. Wasn't there like a TV Dune with Susan Sarandon?
What?
Yeah.
If there is, I've never heard of it. And I'm going to immediately Google that after we're done doing this.
That Susan Sarandon was his mother.
Huh. I don't know. I'm not sure. Well, we'll find out. If there is, I'll put a link in the show notes after we're done. I'm not going to click
it. Okay, I definitely remember a more recent one because I owned it, like, on DVD, like a goober. I know! It was more recent than 1984, but it must have been on TV because this article in The Verge is talking about how that was the last adaptation on film.
Oh, on film.
Was the one in 84, but... I think it was on the Sci-Fi Channel or something like that. Anyway, weird. I distinctly remember watching.
Okay.
But yeah, I haven't seen Arrival or Sicario, so I don't know anything about this director. Mm-hmm. But I am here for a new version of it because there hasn't been one, I don't think, that's like done it any sort of justice or that's good.
I haven't seen Arrival or Sicario either, though they're both very well regarded. I have them. Well, Arrival comes out actually, I think, on DVD next week, which I'm very excited to see. Which is, some of you may know, based on a short story by Ted Chiang, and I can't remember the name of the collection it comes from. So, also Villeneuve has some adaptation experience, taking a short story and making it into a movie. Now he's got to do the other thing, is take a whole bunch of books and try to figure out how to make them into. I guess you just do one. Well. I'm glad Peter Jackson did this because we get 50 Dune movies, right? For however how many books they are. Like, that's Peter Jackson algebra. I'm very interested to see this.
There's six, right?
I don't know. And then some of them, and aren't there ones that's kind of like a Michael Shara situation where you've got like the sun does some and then there's some other things and some, I don't know. I lost track of like the first three. I was like, yeah, I think I'm done. It's enough.
I'm pretty
spice
sure there
for
are
me.
Six that he wrote and then there are more that his. Kid wrote.
Right.
I didn't read any of those.
No, I didn't. When the Offspring picks up the mantle, I'm out.
I'm out.
I do wonder if this is one of those situations where some CGI, you know, maybe we're at a point where some CGI, you can do the worms and everything that make it look
Yeah, I feel
better.
Like it's a hard one to adapt, both because of the, you know, it's a movie about giant worms.
Yeah.
And also, it's got like really kind of strange religious stuff going on, and like sand people who live in a very visually unappealing landscape and like really in like intricate political machinations. It feels very Game of Thrones, but on space.
It's, I was trying to think of like some kind of how do you get to the DNA of Dune? It's like Star Wars plus like political intrigue plus like Mad Max Fury Road.
Like weird ecological stuff. And
like the novel is so dense and sprawling and big that to pare it down to film and be able to do it with any, I don't know, that makes any kind of sense, you've really got to cut away a lot of stuff, which I think is tough. I mean, one thing, you go back and look at Star Wars now, the original one, you know, Lucas was building what he could do and could imagine with film there, and it's really a pretty small movie. You know, it starts out small. The kernel is, you know, a few characters, just a couple locations, and it really builds out into a much bigger film and a franchise now, whereas Dune, it's this whole – it's like this – Cheesecake factory of people, you know, like you look at the Cheesecake Factory menu and all this stuff on it. That's why I feel like Dune is like, there's all this stuff, and how do you figure out what
to do with it? Yeah, I feel like it's way more comparable to Game of Thrones than it is to Star Wars, like in the width of it. Or...
Right, right. Well, at least with Game of Thrones, like, you know, there's not too much CGI, right? It's like, you know, we know how to do that stuff. I mean, there's dragons and stuff.
Well, there's
like,
the dragons. But I guess the worms would be whatever.
Yeah, I guess so. But the whole thing doesn't have to, you know, like it's mostly in the forest with people wearing tunics, you know, like we know how to make those kind of movies. So, and I'd imagine to get it right, it's going to be one of those $150, $200 million budgets. Like it's going to be a big movie. And this is Legendary Pictures. And I'm trying to think, I think they did, no, that was Lionsgate, pardon me, that did The Hunger Games. So that's probably, I mean, the other ones, like I say, that are out there, they tried to do the Ender's Game thing, get that off the ground, and that movie was okay. Did you see that?
No.
The most recent one? It was okay.
I'm not giving dollars to Scott Card's estate.
Yeah, I understand. It was okay, but it didn't do well enough to like get them to make any more. The Foundation trilogy, I guess like the Red Mars stuff in sci-fi land. But anyway, An Auspicious Beginning, and it couldn't be in better hands as far as I can tell from a directorial point of view. But as they say, the proof is in the proof of the pudding is in the eating. So we'll see how this really turns out here.
I really want it to be like Mad Max on Arrakis. Like that's what I want this to be.
Yeah, right. Like an explicit, you know, drugs and everything going in there too. Speaking of, I don't know. I put this in here. I'm not really sure what to say about it.
Weird.
It's just strange. Also, it made me think about how there's not – this is the Franklin School in downtown Washington, D.C. This is an old building. It's been vacant since 2008, but the city itself abandoned the buildings earlier, and it's getting turned basically into a museum of linguistics, which is weird, right?
What?
Yeah. Because linguistics, as far as I know, I've had one introductory linguistics class, which I really found interesting. But it seems to me to have hard to have interesting exhibits about interdental fricatives, you know, and like sibilants and stuff like that. I don't really understand how it's going to work. So they've already raised $3 million towards a $15 million goal. But as we know with museums, that's chicken's feed. They're going to need a whole bunch more than that. It's really kind of weird. On the Planet Word site, I'll put the link in the show notes, the description is something like this. Invites future visitors to identify accents, tell us how you say soda and hoagie, learn tips from professional dialect coaches, and climb a tower of Babel, or run through a tunnel of prepositional phrases. Which to me sounds like a really weird dream I had when I was sick one time, a tunnel of prepositional phrases. It's very, very strange. Unlike anything else in DC or really anywhere. I'm not sure, but this has just made me think about how we really could use like in DC or elsewhere, like a Museum of American Literature or something like that. I guess, you know, the Smithsonian has this and it's kind of balkanized into individual museums and writers' houses and libraries and things like that. But wouldn't it be cool to have, like, you know, somewhere on the Mall or somewhere in D.C., a museum of American literature makes sense in DC, but like, is there a museum of like literature in the world anywhere?
There's the British, in the British Library, they have like Austin's desk and Gutenberg Bible and just like,
right. I guess the British Library is the closest thing. Right. And then of course the British Museum has like the Rosetta Stone. It's, you know, there's, mm-hmm. and that's, I'm not sure you'd really call that a literary document as much a historical one or a philological one, but especially in America, like, of all the things to get money behind, the Linguistics Museum seems super weird. Super weird. I'm not really sure what else to say about this. But what's the best – I was going to ask you, what's the best literary tourism thing you've done?
That's tough.
I've got nothing. I can't give you anything. I wonder if you had a good one.
The Edgar Allan Poe Museum here is pretty good.
It's in Richmond. Oh, right, in Richmond. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's his old house.
It's down by down by the river?
Yeah. It's the oldest standing building in the city still. It was built in like the 16th century. And it's like tiny and creepy and weird. And they have like locks of his hair and like the shroud he was wearing whenever when he like recovered from some illness. It's the most random collection of stuff from a person's life. Mm-hmm. But it seems appropriate, like it's macabre, yeah. and just
it's sort of random and freaky.
They have an unhappy hour, so you yes. can go and like drink in the courtyard and be sad.
right. Yeah, I've been to the British Museum. I guess when I went to see the Globe Theater, the rebuilt one, that was pretty cool. Westminster Abbey's pretty cool, but it's like there's just some buried authors in like this huge church. Like it's kind of like, I don't know, it feels like a footnote. Excuse the pun, because you like walk over their graves. I heard rumor that you might be going to see the remains of the Great Miguel at some point.
Yes,
is that true?
I am. I'm going to Spain at the end of the month, and I'm going to Madrid. And like the only thing that I have on my list, aside from like eat all the tapas,
yes.
is go to the cathedral. Well, not cathedral. It's like a convent where he is supposedly buried, but there's no like confirmation. And getting in there is impossible because they only the nuns will only let you in right after mass. So you have to like go to mass.
That's how
and I'm
get
a Catholic,
you.
So I have no you. Idea. Mass in Spanish. Like I don't speak either of those languages. I don't speak, you know.
Mass? You don't speak Catholic?
I don't speak Catholic. I do speak a little bit of Spanish, but like I'm not going to follow any of that. And then they will like usher you to the crypt where he may or may not be buried with 15 other people in a giant pile. So, but I'm going.
I think we did a story, or we covered that on the podcast a while ago.
Yeah,
like there was like a pile of bones. Like, yeah, this might be Cervantes' thumb, we think, maybe.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But there's also, there's a bar, a really old like art deco bar in Madrid where Hemingway used to hang out, and apparently you can go and like sit in his booth. So I'm gonna do that.
You know, you can't swing a dead cat in Europe without hitting a bar Hemingway used to sit at.
That is super true. And I would love to sit in all of them.
Yeah.
That sounds like a good time to me.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. So the Museum of Linguistics coming soon. Have you ever been to the Folger Shakespeare Library in DC?
I have not.
That's one thing I want to go to, and it's not open all the time. Like it's a closed library. I actually read a book a couple weeks ago about the making of the Folger Shakespeare Library. Believe it or not, that's how boring I am. But it sounds really interesting. Did you know that the Folger Shakespeare Library has a full 42% of the extant first folios? He has 82 of them.
Wow,
it's insane! It's an insane collection. Anyway, so there's the weird Museum of Linguistics. Speaking of literary arcana, it's Literary Arcana Week here on the show. I guess it's appropriate when you're on the show that we do like super nerdy stuff that no one else cares about.
Just us.
Yeah. And I looked up how to say this guy's name, and I didn't find any help. So I'm going to just try from what I see. But Zhu Yunyang died a couple weeks ago. Almost a month ago now, January 13th, 2017, he was 111 years old. And here's what he did. He led the charge to create a Roman alphabet for Chinese. Basically, he was charged by the political leadership of China of finding a way to translate the ideograms of written Chinese into a modern alphabet. Where they could actually, you know, write it in a more really speed, right?
That's like
a standardized way. So there's a couple things. It's a fascinating story. There was a long profile in the New York Times that really only scratched the surface of what this would kind of take to do. But one thing you can say about an authoritarian regime, if you need to do something really crazy, huge, and improbable, like rewriting your written language, this is they get it done in that particular way. So just a couple of things that come up when you think about. So probably most of you know that Chinese is ideograms, which are basically like remnants or not remnants, but they've evolved from really graphical representations of what they're trying to describe into, you know, symbols for those things. But you have to be able to see them to understand what they are. And one thing that's nice about that is if you speak different dialects of Chinese, even if you couldn't understand each other talking to each other, the written language was all the same. So it had that going for it. But if you're doing things like trying to develop a keyboard, for example, it's super hard to have tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of ideograms readily available to you. Also very difficult for non-native speakers to learn. Famously very difficult to learn Chinese before there was a Roman alphabet. But also even things like accessibility. If you're blind, you have a really tough time because the Braille system uses, you know, the nice thing about an alphabet is it's combinatorial, right? So you only need a handful of discrete symbols, but in combinations and in combinations you can create, you know, because of math, almost virtually unlimited number of combinations that can be a bunch of different words. So really interesting guy. He also was a political dissident.
I love all of
for
his
like
quotes.
The last 50. I mean, the thing that's crazy is he started this project in looks like 1958, and he was already 50 years old. You know, so like he had a long life, and he's not as well known in China than he could be. Like, it's kind of amazing, right? Like, it feels like something would happen in the ancient world. Like, some guy's like, you know, we're gonna make a written language out of this. Like, what? It's crazy. Mm-hmm. But he was. His historical place was downplayed because of his political dissident to the Chinese government. He wasn't a linguist by training. He was a banker and he had some international experience. So it's not really clear to me how he got the job. They kind of gloss over it in this profile, but it seemed worth noting the passing of someone who did something sort of unprecedented. Like it seems to me it's something on the order of like writing the Oxford English Dictionary to take on a project of such magnitude here. Anything else in this story you wanted to that you thought was interesting?
He wrote more than 40 books. That's amazing.
That is
amazing.
10
of them were published after he turned 100. That's so good.
It's never too late. It's never too late.
In all
right?
honesty, I haven't got anything good to say about Mao Zedong.
Yeah.
I love this guy. it gives me a lot of hope, actually, because like at the top of the profile, they're talking about an interview he did in 2012 with the BBC where he was like, yes, I am. You know, I'm a dissident or whatever. What are they going to do? Lock me up? You know, and he's right. like 110. And so I have hope for when I'm like
yeah.
quite old and I'm no longer worried about being arrested.
Yeah,
what
right.
Are you gonna do?
You're old,
what are you
this
do?
Is like your ultimate, like your grandma don't care moment.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. I've survived 60 years of authoritarian regimes. I invented written Chinese as you know it. And I'm going to say some stuff about Mao.
What do you want from me?
Yeah. In terms of the impact, again, almost incalculable to estimate, except that there's a couple numbers that I thought were extremely striking. As you might imagine, Chinese was learned by most Chinese people orally, right? The easiest way to learn it that way, as most kids are. But in terms of literacy, it's very hard to teach. And as a result, illiteracy remained rampant throughout China well into the 20th century, affecting by some estimates as much as 85% of the population. And the literacy rates rose dramatically, quickly. I mean, they institute this on one specific day, right? February 11th, 1958. That's to the day. Like, that's crazy to me that all of a sudden you just had it written a different written language than you did before. Anyway, there you go. So that's someone that's worth noting. It's like that this is the kind of thing that happens. This a guy was alive in our lifetime. Well, I think at some time will seem weird. So that's wanted to pass that along. I thought you guys might be interested in that. All right, let's go to more standard sort of Book Riot podcast kind of news. One book, one New York. You want to take a stab at this one? You want to tell people what's going on with this?
Yeah, sure. So there is a initiative, I guess, that the New York City Mayor's Office is doing with Commissioner. It's called One Book, One New York, which is an initiative to get everyone in the city reading the same book at the same time. But they haven't picked it. They've picked 5 books for New Yorkers to choose from. So you can go to this article on BuzzFeed, which we will link to see some celebrities explaining why they think you should pick XYZ. So the 5 books they've got, Between the World and Me, The Ta-Nehisi Coates, Americana, by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, The Sellout, which was a huge book last year by Paul Beatty, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, everybody knows that, and The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Juno Diaz. I'm not sure how you... Oh, here you go. To vote for your favorite book, you have to just go to the site for the thing. Yeah. You can follow the hashtag. Interesting picks.
Yeah, good picks.
Not a lot of surprises. No. Tree Grows in Brooklyn's a little surprising. That's kind of an old...
It's so surprising. I guess it's surprising because the rest of the picks feel... I mean, they're more contemporary by decades, yeah, yeah. Right? I don't know. Have you ever done one of these city-long read-along things? Uh-huh. I always wonder how effective these are. Because you see, like, Chicago does one, I think, and other cities mm-hmm. do them. Right now in Portland, the Multnomah County Library System is... they're trying to lead a discussion or whatever. You know, one city read of a book called Evicted that's about... affordable housing and housing policy. This is something that comes up from time to time. I think it's cool. I'm just never sure what's the point of it. What are they trying to do exactly?
I get what they're trying to do. I get that they're trying to have a unifying conversation about something across the city. But the cities that the places that do these sorts of things in Portland, New York, Chicago, are the places that, in my mind, are in least need of having these kind of conversations. Like, does New York really need to talk about Between the World and Me? Like, I mean, obviously there was police brutality stuff happening in New York and all that, but I feel like maybe, I don't know, like if a city in rural Idaho did one city, one Idaho, whatever, and picked Between the World and Me, I think that would be a more interesting.
Or like Missoula, Montana, read Missoula.
Missoula, yeah, right, yeah. Yeah. Like, if I felt like this moved any kind of needle, I think I would find it more.
So it's sort of almost like a preaching to the choir situation for you a little bit. I guess that makes sense.
Maybe not. I don't live in New York, so.
The kind of places that can get up enough steam to do something like this means there's steam there to get up to do it, right? I guess I'm just not sure. Like, there's going to be conversations where? On Twitter? Like, what? Let's say I was still living in New York and I decided I'm going to read I'm going to pick The Sellout and, like, read it along. I'm just not sure. I guess to me, it's like, I guess, and I don't mean this pejoratively, it's glorified book recommendations, right? I mean, which is fine. This is just a heck of an effort. Like, you've got Larry Wilmore and William H. Macy and B.B. Newworth, like, making videos and talk, like, a lot of effort that went into this. I'm just not sure.
I think I would have to look at the other ones. Like, I know Chicago has done theirs for a while. I'd like to see their numbers, but they've got like Oprah, you know. So
yeah, and it's all literary. I mean, also it's literary fiction and nonfiction. I don't know. There's just something about this that, again, it's not bad. I'm just a little. I've seen these before. I leave myself scratching my head, but this is the biggest initiative I've ever seen of this kind, as far as I can. As BuzzFeed's behind it, they seem to be. I don't know, some kind of media partner for it. And you have the celebrity stuff and a dedicated site. And I just don't know. Like, I guess you do it and then you think that, yay, that was good. I'm just not sure.
Yeah. I'm sure they have, I mean, this is just what I would do, but I'm sure they have like meetups at the libraries.
Meetups, you can go talk about it. Yeah, maybe.
Have the authors come in, do a thing.
I'm not sure. And watching celebrities pitch a book, like, again, I guess I'm just not, I just don't care about that. So maybe the wrong.
Well, we could talk about that. We got a thing about the celebrity book clubby thing.
Yeah, let's go to that. Yeah. I find that much more interesting, I have to say.
Okay, do you?
Wait, well, I don't know. Okay, you tell me what that is then, since you
All right. So Kim Kardashian, who is, I did not know this, but who is best friends with Chrissy Teigen, are starting a book club.
Right.
On Twitter. Or I don't know if the book club is happening on Twitter, but they announced it on Twitter. That they're starting a book club. And the first book that they're reading is Embraced by the Light by Betty J. Eadie?
I don't know how you say it. Yeah, I don't know. E-A-D-I-E.
I don't know, which is a strange, weird pick in my brain. I mean, it's a bestseller. It was published in the early 90s. It's about the author's near-death experience. Like, it seems like one of those, whatever, those, like, I almost died and saw heaven and came back to life and here's my hallucination that I'm presenting to you as fact kind of a thing.
Right.
That is, like, super popular. So they're reading that, and it seems like they're doing most of the talking about it on social media. Kim has talked about it on Snapchat a little bit. Chrissy has tweeted about it. So, this is, like, a thing that's happening now, I think. Like, Emma Watson started a book club.
Yeah. Andrew Luck, we talked about here at the book club before. I guess that's the thing that's interesting to me about it is like that the idea of a book club is something that people, even at the height of celebrity fame exposure, like are interested in doing. You know, even, you know, who has more possible social engagements than Kim Kardashian.
Yeah, than a Kardashian, yeah.
And yet still there's something about – and I tried to – I watched a little bit, and the explanation of why they're doing it is not really out there, except it seems like they want to.
Yeah.
The pick itself is interesting, I guess. There's no like – I mean, philosophy or why they're trying to do it. They just want to do it, which I think is really super interesting. Just that, like, I don't know, that a book club is – the idea of a book club is so compelling that they'll do it, that they'll just want to do it. And what does that mean to them to have a book club on social media? Like, they're going to talk about it? They're going to post about
it?
Yeah, there's no right way to do it. I just find the whole thing fascinating as an experiment. Because we talked before on the show about, you know, the Oprah's book club and mm-hmm. that the power of that to sell books and get people talking about a book has declined, and mostly by neglect, I think, because Oprah got tired of doing it or whatever. And there hasn't really been a substitute for this, you know. And I'm sure that I'll have to see if I can drag up some numbers, but like how many units of Embraced by the Light does this sell? Like no one has a bigger social media following than this.
Yeah.
No one. Like, it's got to sell some copies, but how many? Like, are they going to get paid to do any of this stuff? You know, I'm fascinated by this
idea. I wouldn't put it past, I mean, like, that seems to be Kim Kardashian's, like, deal, right?
It's right.
Social media sponsorship.
Like, stuff. She does, and again, I don't follow her on anything except that I've seen a couple stories on the marketing side of she will, like, do a face cream ad on Snapchat or something, basically,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and take, I would assume, an exorbitant amount of money. On the other hand, as both you and I know, I can't imagine that whoever published Embraced by the Light's going to give her $100,000 or whatever.
No,
I don't even
really
know what
it
might be to do it. So the motives behind it are interesting. And like this thing about dying, like that she's openly thinking about her mortality seems to me super interesting, right?
Like, well, she's got, what, like two kids now?
That's what happens. She's two kids, but also someone who clearly is – and look, this goes back to the ancient world of people worried about their own publicity and their own way they'll be remembered and things of that nature. No one seems to be playing the modern publicity game better than Kim Kardashian. So I just think this is super interesting that the first pick in this book club of these super famous, very attractive women who spend a lot of their time because it's part of their brand identity – keeping themselves looking young and fit and healthy and whatever. Their first book is about dying. It's just I find the whole – it's almost like something out of a satire to me. Like, you know, it's something that Gary Steingart would write, like a celebrity book club where all the books are about being – are about aging or being forgotten or dying or something like that. I'd be curious to – like a lot of these book clubs I've seen pop up that celebrities do, they get like some mention early, but then they fade away. I think a lot of book clubs themselves, even run by non-celebrities, let's start a book club. Okay, we met twice, and then it sort of goes away.
Yeah.
I'd be interesting to see how long it runs.
Zuckerberg's thing, is he still doing that?
No, I don't think so. That was a year, and it did go for a year.
Did it? I lost interest after two.
We lost interest as well. Rebecca and I were talking about it. Like, we started the picks, but then nothing else happened. He's like, this week's pick, or this, I think there was two a month every other week, is this book, and then there'd be a bunch of spammy Facebook comments on that post, and that was it.
Yeah.
Well,
and that's the thing that I find, like, not just the fact that it's Kim Kardashian, who I didn't know was a reader. It's not, like, surprising to me. She seems like a smart person.
Yes,
but I had never heard of that in her, coverage in the media. But also, like, how do you do a book club on Twitter? Like, the mechanics of this thing that seems very much like a thing they just, like, were sitting
right
on their sofas and were like, hey, this sounds like fun, let's, you know, and then tweeted about it, and now it's like a thing that people are anticipating some sort of structure around, but I don't think there's going to be any. So like, well, Emma Watson's book club is very structured, and there's like ways you can participate, and it's got like a point, you know, she's doing this whole like feminist intersectionality thing,
and that's all on Goodreads, right? The Emma Watson's book club,
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Instagram too, and I don't understand how this is going to work, but it'd be interesting to watch. I don't think I follow either of them on anything, but
no, I don't either. Tegan, I see her. She comes up in my feed by other people's retweets, and she seems funny and interesting. I have to say, I should follow her.
She just came out with a cookbook that Rebecca really loves.
So. Oh, and it sold a jillion copies too.
Yeah,
I think we may have talked about that. I mean, it could be as simple as they got together and they're like, you know, I want to read more books, or you want to read this book with me. It's like, let's do a book. Like, that's how these things happen, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
it just so happens.
That's how I started. Yeah,
they've got the largest. Social media platforms available to them. So suddenly it's a thing.
I find Kim Kardashian just like really fascinating, kind of. So
yeah, I do too. I mean, I'm not a hater. I mean, I'm not a fan or a hater necessarily. More of a semi-interested observer.
She reminds me a lot of Jessica Simpson, where there was that same phenomenon when Jessica Simpson was famous, where it was like, everyone thinks she's dumb and she's pretty, so she must be stupid. But in reality, she's like turned a horrible situation where she became immediately famous because of a sex tape into this like huge multi-million-dollar industry just based on how nice her lips are. Like, that's amazing. She's brilliant. Right. Like, she's done something right, you know, in the same way that Jessica Simpson did that whole like act about being dumb and then now doesn't ever have to work again because we're all actually stupid and gave her money for it. So.
Right. Well, and I mean, not to do the statistics things, but there are a lot of attractive people out there. Just because you're attractive guarantees you nothing, right?
Right.
So something else is going on. I'm not really sure what to make of it. It's the thing I always think about when I see a story about Kim Kardashian or something else, what an exhausting life it looks to lead in this way. It just looks like a horror show of being prepared and accessible and trying to put content about yourself out all the time. It just seems like a horrible mess. It's hard enough, it seems to me, to get out of the door, get the kids to school, and get back in time to record a podcast, what they're doing.
Well, she's got some help, I'm sure.
I mean, it does. I guess the thing, I don't mean to dwell over it, but I'm going to, so just bear with me for a second out there, is that what is it about the idea of a book club that people find so interesting? Like, the stats about the number of people that are in book clubs are staggering. Like, a lot of people are in book clubs. And especially, it's mostly women, but also men are in book clubs too. But there's something about wanting to, and I don't know what it is. I really don't understand what it's. You feel like you haven't been engaged enough with your life somehow. Is it the social kind of contract you make with other people that helps you? It's kind of like going to AA, right? Like, but you want to do more reading, but you need sort of a structure and a support system of other people doing it as well. Like, the endurance of the idea of a book club in our modern age, I think, is something really interesting to wonder about. And the history of book clubs is interesting. Like, it goes back to, like, the self-improvement societies. Like, Ben Franklin started one, the mutual improvement societies, where you'd have to, you know, it's related also to, like, the Eagles or what are the other ones? Ah, gollies. Rotarians, right? You come and you see a lecture and you have to ask a question and all this kind of stuff. But there's something to this ad hoc and then rarely structured way of getting together with other people from time to time to learn something that you maybe aren't doing by yourself, that I find a really interesting phenomenon. And it goes up to the very height of celebrity and privilege and resources. Like, this, it doesn't discriminate, apparently, along these
lines. Well, my book club has been meeting for over a year at this point, I think. And it's, I would say the motivation is mostly to get out of, like, the head in the sand kind of way that we can all just get in our own lives and not pay attention to what our friends are doing or whatever. And I mean, like, to be blunt, a lot of it is about, like, getting away from your kids for a night and drinking a glass of wine with a human being who is your age.
Sure.
So I think that's probably a lot of people's reasons for having a book club, is just to, like, get out of your house and talk to a person about a thing that is not your family or your partner or your bills or your job or whatever.
Right. And as you get older, I guess, you also aren't just, like, looking to go to see a band at a club or something. Like, it's a replacement social experience, right? Value over replacement experience is pretty high at that point, because you don't have to go pay. You know, it's low key. You probably, unless you're Kardashian, I guess, you don't get dressed up necessarily if you don't want to. No, I mean, I don't mean that pejoratively. Yeah. Like, it's a relatively low it's the resource requirement is pretty low to get together about it. But there's so many vectors of interest. The book club does so many functions, possibly, that's why I endure so much, because it's kind of a Swiss Army social event. Like, it can be about getting out of the house, but it's also cheap. But also, you get to read books and talk, and, you know, you have something to talk about that replaces, I guess, just talking about nothing or gossiping or you know, talking about the horror show of current events. Just the whole idea is fascinating to me, that it's such an enduring and alluring social institution that we don't know very much about. Like, what other things do people do regularly that we just don't have much information about, or it's all done ad hoc? Like, I don't know. I find it fascinating. All right. Let me do another sponsor this week. You know, this is something that's happening more and more. We get graphic novel – supplements or sequels or alternative history to regular sort of prose books. And this one is Wires and Nerve by Marissa Mayer. And it's her first graphic novel, and it's extending the world of the Lunar Chronicles. So, you know, some of you may know this as better as Cinder, Cress, Scarlet Winter, and the rest of the Rampion crew. It's a brand new action-packed story about Iko, the android with a heart of mechanized gold. So when a rogue pack of wolf hybrid soldiers threaten the tenuous peace between Earth and Luna, Iko takes upon herself to hunt down the soldiers' leader. She is soon working with a handsome royal guard, of course, who forces her to question everything she knows about love, loyalty, and her own family. And it has appearances by Cinder, Cress, Scarlet, and Winter. And so it's interesting. I don't know this series well enough to say that extends, but it's ciliary. Like, it's almost like Rogue One to Star Wars. Like, it's filling in some other piece, some other part of the world for people who love this story, want to get into it in a different way, is really interesting. Again, it's called Wires and Nerve. It's her first graphic novel. It's available wherever you can go buy books. So go check out Wires and Nerve. I have to say, I thumbed through it, and it's really beautiful. It's a really beautiful color palette. And graphically done. So go check that out. Maybe someone that likes graphic novels can introduce them to this series this way. That series has sold 1 billion copies, really successful, and good for Marissa Mayer and the whole crew over there. So it's Wires and Nerve, available now. You know what? Let's talk about extending universes. The new George R. R. Martin Game of Thrones short story, ironically, possibly timed. We just talked about how he said maybe I think probably 2017 will be the year of the next full installment.
Sure,
sure. You're an unbeliever. I can tell already.
I'm so mad.
I don't know this about you. You're a Game of Thrones lady. Have you read the books?
I got to book 3 and then I stopped, and this was years ago, and was like, okay, I'll pick up book 4 when Winds of Winter comes out, because then I won't get too far ahead, you know, I won't get too far ahead. And that was, I mean, years ago. And like, I'm still. Yeah,
that was like in the Carter administration, right?
Seriously. And now the show is passing Winds of Winter, and like, what's the point? And I don't want to watch the show until the book is out. And like,
because of Neil's razor.
I know. It's so obnoxious. And I'm not the person who feels like artists owe me.
Sure.
Whatever. And he can take his time. Fine. But could you, like, if you're going to do all this writing, could you, like, write the book and not all this other stuff?
Well, apparently this is something he wrote earlier. Like, that's why the timing is auspicious, because he just made this thing, and now it's like, there's this other short story about what's going on there. So it sounds like it came from some other offshoot of something he was working on. But there's a new short story coming out. I was thinking about got some follow-up about when Rebecca and I were talking about, you know, what to make of this, and people were like, nah, that most of the feedback we got is we don't believe him at all, which is, I mean, look, that is fair. If a past performance is any indication of future performance, then certainly you would be wise to bet on it not coming out. I just wonder, this is unlike any other intellectual property franchise I've ever heard of, even in historical terms, of how much the franchise seems to have gotten away from him, both in terms of that the series is now, I guess he consults on it, and maybe he gave them some outline where it's going, but it's taken on a life of its own. But he himself doesn't seem to be able to corral whatever he wants to do into putting it out. I feel bad for him at this point. Like, I mean, again, I'm never going to feel bad for someone who's making bajillions of dollars in that kind of way, but in sort of an artistic way, the internet and the TV show, which maybe it was not wise for him to sign off to let it be done when the books weren't out, and he historically had trouble getting them out in anything like a timely fashion. Like, the joke now is, like, Book Riot is younger than the last Song of Ice and Fire book. We're in 5.5 years old now. So anyway, it's tough. It's a tough situation, and I hope that it gets resolved, because I'd like to read the books. I can't watch the show, because the older I get and with kids and whatever now, I think you and I have talked, the violence on TV stuff I really have trouble with. So for some reason, reading it seems a little more interesting. You know, that's more palatable somehow. I don't know what that is about either. But this is a cultural phenomenon I've missed the boat on. And I said the similar thing. Like, I'll get started, you know, maybe when the penultimate book out. That's a That's a loophole in O'Neill's Razor. I don't know if you know, but if the penultimate book is out, you can then read that one, because then you're just waiting on the last one. You know, it's one thing to wait on however many, three, the Harry Potter mistake, which generated O'Neill's Razor, because I read four and like, no, this is a disaster of waiting for three. But if the penultimate one is released, then you are free. You can, with good conscience and in full, the force of weight of O'Neill's Razor is behind you in going ahead and reading the series if the penultimate one is published. So I need to wait on, I guess, this one and the next one, because there's supposed to be seven. Who knows?
Yeah, we'll see. I
don't even know at this point. Anyway, so let's go on here. Where do you want to go to next? We got some stuff we haven't covered. Why don't you pick the next one?
I want to talk about this kid thing.
Yeah. You found this one. I hadn't seen this. Talk to me about this one.
All right. So there were three teenagers in Virginia, which is why I feel compelled to talk about this, who vandalized a historic African-American schoolhouse in Virginia with a bunch of swastikas in October. They haven't been named, obviously, because they're minors, but they pled guilty. And their punishment, or whatever word you want to use, their sentence, is that the judge is requiring them to both visit the Holocaust Museum and read some books. So instead of going to jail or to, what do you call jail for kids?
Yeah, juvenile detention. Juvie.
Yeah, instead of going to juvie, they have homework, basically. So they have to write a book report each month from a list of books that the judge assigned them.
Hmm.
And the list consists of things like The Color Purple and The Kite Runner and Native Son. The judge said she wanted the books to cover race and religion, gender and war, to illustrate oppression all over the world. And the kids' parents were apparently like so mortified by what they did that they already took them to the Holocaust Museum, like before the sentence was handed down, before they knew that was what the sentence was going to be. They like already took their kids, which is like, good job.
Yeah, parenting. Right. Good parenting.
Yeah. So I think that's so interesting to like assign books instead of prison time for something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think both of you and I are probably along the same way, like anything that's not prison probably seems like a better idea, especially for kids, right? Like I'm not sort of a lock them away early kind of situation. And this is a disturbing incident for sure. We did a story a while back, I think it was Italy, that you could get your jail time reduced for reading books for adults. So if, you know, it was one of our questions, like how do you have to do a book report? Like how does it work? Mm-hmm. You get your book at passport out and they give you a stamp and instead of free pizza, you get 2 years taken off. I'm not really sure. It's a fascinating idea because as they say, the idea of juvenile detention and juvenile corrections is rehabilitation, right? And one thing prisons are notoriously bad at is rehabilitation. You often come out worse than you went in because of the situations and what kind of life station you come out the other side in. It makes sense to me. It would be cool if it wasn't just a sort of one-off idiopathic, this particular judge decided. Like if there were some structure around certain kinds of juvenile crimes could have, I guess, an educational component, I guess, is really what this is, right?
Yeah.
And the idea being that the fount of this particular crime is an ignorance of history.
Yeah, well, apparently two of the kids were minorities.
Oh, or interesting.
No. What did she say? What can I tell you about them is that three of them were minorities, two of them were white, which is math that doesn't make sense to me. I don't know what that means, but whatever. None of them knew the building was a school. They didn't know it was a historic property. So they didn't know that they were like drawing swastikas on an African-American schoolhouse, which is, you know, the optics of that are not great.
But I mean, you shouldn't draw swastikas in anywhere,
Kids, especially in this, like, This is in October, and still, you know, back in October, recently, like, hate crimes are on the rise. The normalization of Nazi symbols is a thing that's real, and I feel like teenage boys who were out, you know, graffitiing crap they saw in the news that they don't necessarily understand.
Yeah,
should probably not go to jail. Like that seems kind of, I don't know. I mean, they're children. Like their critical thinking parts of their brains are not fully developed, so.
And I don't know. I mean, it doesn't say much about the ages here.
The Holocaust Museum was a good idea.
Yeah, it seems like a good idea. Like, I don't remember. Like, when were you aware of, like, the Holocaust? And would you even know what a swastika really meant at 13? I'm not sure that I would have. Just guessing, like, at what point would you have known necessarily?
Well, the Holocaust, one of the Holocaust museums is here in Richmond.
Also down by the Poe Museum, actually, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it is.
Weirdly, yeah.
And in middle school, we took a field trip to it. And that, like, is a memory that really stuck in my mind because that was, you know, I didn't have any real knowledge or understanding of what that meant. And a lot of the kids in my class were Jewish, and we went to the, the synagogue that's attached to the Holocaust Museum here. And some of them had relatives who had died, and it was like all very emotional. And so that's when I went through it. If they didn't have that experience, then maybe they just had no context.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't say the ages here. I don't think we're led to believe just they're teenagers, which could be any number. Cause I went to Germany when I was 15 and went to Dachau and saw the camp there, and indelible marked on me as almost anyone who goes would be. But before that, I'm not sure that the reality I would have known enough to even know what I was doing if I had the intention or whatever these kids had to do. And again, like, as you said, the normalization, like I never in a million years thought I would see as many swastikas in my daily consumption of life, as we see now. And one thing we know about social norms and social proof, especially with kids, is they pick up, you know, like it's like, it becomes like slang. It's something that becomes, that's being trafficked in the symbolism in the day, in the language of the day, and horribly decontextualized. And I think that's the real move here, is to say, all right, if you're going to write that sign, you got to learn about what's going on around this kind of hate and this kind of attitude and this kind of history. Seems fair to me. I wonder what other crimes could you assign reading to do
reading for
teenagers?
Nonviolent hate crimes seem to be
right
particularly appropriate for that. I mean, like, violent hate crimes, you should go to prison. Yeah. You know, obviously. But I mean, like, if you rob a bank, are you going to read a book about?
Yeah, I get. I'm trying to think of what are the sort of the petty crimes of teenagers. You know, like drinking beer, MIPs, stuff like that. I'm not sure what book would really help you with that necessarily. Also, I the idea too that the judge has that this kind of work might actually work is interesting. You know, that literature and reading can have a ameliorative effect on people is one of those ideas I know that we often write around or I'm not sure we don't believe a book right necessarily, but we're careful to say reading isn't magic, right? It's just if you just read something, like, you know, it's not like antibiotics for the soul or something like this.
You can still be a bigot.
You can still be a bigot. So that's also, again, not that going to jail is great either for making you for rehabilitating you, but that also correlation of the expectation here is that if you read this particular set of books, there will be some outcome in your moral fiber is a complicated and problematic one. But it might be the best of all bad choices in this particular case.
I also feel like it's different for kids, though. Like,
yes,
what a kid reads in those like very formative sort of years matters to who they grow up to be. So,
well, and both you and I just said that we had very strong experiences going to Holocaust museums. So clearly, I'm not saying that there's no connection between reading and education and outcomes of how you actually turn out. It's just read these, like, turning book reading into like the very sort of codified prescription of like 6 months, 8 months, 9 months in jail. It doesn't line up in quite the same ways. Though I'm still for it. It's just there's all the different questions that come up. If you use it as reading as punishment's a weird one, right? I don't know about that. Anyway, an interesting story. Really interesting. I've never seen anything like this that people were prescribed, or I guess sentenced to sentences. I was waiting the whole time to get at that. Yeah, I should get there. Let's see. Did we get through all of them? Oh, no. We got the big one. This was going to lead the whole show.
Wait, what?
Hillary.
Oh, HRC.
HRC. Yeah. Announced last week that Hillary Rodham Clinton will publish a book of personal essays, which is going to come out in the fall of 2017 from Simon & Schuster, stories from Clinton's life, stuff about the 2016 presidential election, and also a collection of inspirational quotations, her own commonplace book, I guess, we'll get in there. So anyway, there you go. You know, good, right? I mean, I'm interested to see what she has here. Striking while the iron is warm, I suppose. She's kept a relatively low profile in the days since the election. Like, have you seen some of those, like, random Instagram encounters of, like, seeing her hiking and stuff like that? Have you seen those? Yeah.
She's, like, out walking her dog in the woods.
She's out Cheryl Strading it or something out there. But President and CEO of Simon & Schuster, Carolyn Reedy, brought world rights in all formats. Do you think this has anything to do with that other guy?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I do. I'm not sure. But it feels like a calculated kind of thing. Yeah. I was surprised that she went with Simon & Schuster, but...
Do you think she knows?
I don't know.
Michelle was urging me to write. Michelle has been urging me to write an open letter to her on the site about SNS and what they
BTW, white supremacists. I don't know. I mean, she's an author, so she's not unfamiliar with how publishing news. I'm sure, but
that's I just don't know how granular plugged in she is. Yeah,
inside baseball kind of story.
Yeah,
that Simon & Schuster is publishing a white supremacist.
I don't.
She might not care. I mean, she might be so out of. She probably has blocked the word Breitbart on her Facebook feed, you know?
I'm not sure how she's getting her news. Like, what would it take for that to bubble up into her whatever enclave of information gathering is right now? Like, I don't even know. My sister-in-law is from a small town in Kansas that they have a museum of also-rans. Like, if you lose the presidential election, you get the museum and exhibit or whatever. And I've always been sort of fascinated in the future history, or especially the immediate aftermath of someone who lost a presidential election, because you have all this apparatus around you, right? Right through – basically the election is called, and then it's over, and it's like – you know, you see like John Kerry walking around with his dog and his Asics, you know, and stuff like this. And I just don't know what then the pattern of your life becomes. Like, does she have a body man or body woman like she surely once had? Does she have Secret Service? Does she have the whole staff? Like, how much is left?
And well, she still has Secret Service because she's the former first lady.
Right. And that's an additional complication, right, is that you've got multiple layers of protection and political history behind you. But, like, is she reading the Huffington Post to see the news, and what is she seeing necessarily? Is her agent telling her anything? It's impossible to know. But it's a little too – let's say it followed hard upon, to use the Shakespearean, the other guy's announcement for SNS to go out and grab this. Probably didn't hurt the bidding for Hillary that one particular party may have had incentive to do this. But that's coming out in the fall. Book of Essays. It'll be interesting to see. I guess it's a little quick, I guess. Usually these take a little longer. But it's also not a big sort of my life kind of book thing. It's a collection of essays, so it can be
it's not a
disparate
memoir.
And discreet in that particular way. Well, I think that's our show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks to our sponsors, Wires and Nerve by Marissa Meyer. Thanks to Madison Reed, Madison-Reed, R-E-E-D.com. Use offer code – or go slash book right there. And Casper Mattresses, CASPER.com/bookriot. And then you go to that URL and then use offer code bookriot, one word, to get $50 off a better mattress, a better sleep, and a better life. That's a transitive property I'm using there a little bit. Amanda, thanks for being on the show. We'll talk to you soon.